Yesterday I was reading Chakravarti Thakura to verses 30 and 31 of the ninth chapter, in which Krishna is revealing his inner feelings about his devotees. This is one of the great distinguishing features of bhakti yoga, that Krishna becomes purchased by the devotion of the devotee. Krishna actually becomes the property of his devotee. And their relationship is very deep and very intimate and extremely affectionate. So, first of all, that was shown in verse 22. We made the point that Krishna is prepared to even contradict the laws of karma as far as his devotees are concerned. And then 30 and 31 are explaining in a very vivid way that the devotee is so dear to Krishna that even if the devotee does something terrible, suduracha, extremely bad, or as Ramanujacharya says, exceedingly wicked. So this is really something quite extreme. This is not just making a small mistake or slipping up in some way. But even if the devotee does something extreme, extremely bad, but as long as the devotee remains ananya bhava, fully engaged in devotional service, then the devotee remains very dear to Krishna. In fact, Krishna helps the devotee to become rectified. And such a devotee who is basically sincere is quickly rectified. So anyway, we were describing the conversation between Krishna and Arjuna as described by Srila Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, that Krishna was expressing himself very strongly. Arjuna was protesting that I can't accept it. That such a devotee would be considered a saint. I can't accept it. But Krishna was insisting, no, no. To the point that Krishna became angry. His eyes became red with anger. According to our acharyas, Krishna even said that if you don't accept this, I take it as an offense against myself if you don't accept what I'm saying. So then Arjuna sort of backed down a bit and said, all right, I'm prepared to accept it if you say so. But what about other people? How are they going to understand it? And then Krishna said that you take drums and kartels and you go and gather the people and you convince them. You tell them, Kanteya Pratijani. Now the question arises, why does Krishna say to Arjuna that you declare? Why doesn't Krishna say that I declare? Well, the reason for that is that Krishna, sometimes, he makes a promise and then he breaks his promise. Sometimes. Not that he's whimsical about it, like he's in the habit of doing it as a general practice. But sometimes, under certain important circumstances, Krishna does that. Like Krishna in the battle of Kurukshetra, at the beginning he said, I won't fight. But when Arjuna was being threatened by Bhishma, then Krishna picked up the wheel of the chariot and he rushed towards Bhishma to kill him. But then the sun set right at that very instant. So Krishna didn't actually follow through with it and actually kill him. But he was going to do it. He was right in the middle of doing it. So Krishna breaks his word sometimes. Not whimsically though. Under what circumstances does Krishna break his word? If upholding his word means that his devotee is inconvenienced or things will go against his devotee, then Krishna will break his word. Generally, of course, Krishna's word is truth. Just Krishna's desire is fact. But if anything actually interferes with the devotee, then Krishna's prepared to do anything, break his word, do something immoral. Because the highest standard of morality is that Krishna loves his devotee, and the devotee loves Krishna, and that exchange of love must go on. That is the highest principle of activity. So Krishna may break his word if it appears that upholding his word will adversely affect a devotee. But if the devotee gives his word that I say that Krishna's devotee, not I, but Arjuna, if Arjuna says that I say that Krishna's devotee will never perish, I give my word. Then if the devotee gives his word or her word, Krishna feels bound that I must uphold the word of my devotee. And if upholding the word of my devotee means that some other principle has to be broken, then I'll break that other principle. But my devotee's word will be upheld. So that's why Krishna says, Kanteya Pratijani. Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur describes that Krishna is thinking that here I am right in the middle of speaking Bhagavad Gita. And it's very important that people accept Bhagavad Gita and take it very seriously and then apply it. So if I now give my word in the middle of Bhagavad Gita and just a little while later break my word, then they'll think, well, what is the value of this Bhagavad Gita? Krishna's saying so many things, but, you know, maybe what he's saying in Bhagavad Gita isn't true because he breaks his promise. He made a promise right in the middle of Bhagavad Gita. But then he breaks his promise. So Krishna was thinking this may reflect badly on Bhagavad Gita. So therefore he didn't want to give him his own word. Although later on, in the 18th chapter, Krishna does take a type of a vow. He says that I'll deliver my devotees from their sinful reactions. So, now we go on to the last section, which is verses 32, 33, and 34. The idea here is that devotional service and the opportunity to reach the perfectional stage of devotional service is available to everyone. Want to speak of Sri Vaishya Sudra, but even the Papa Yonis, Sri Vaishya Sudra, they're at least within Varnashram. But the Papa Yonis, that means those who are less, they're like untouchables. Kirata Nandra Pulinda Pukasha, Abira Shumpa, Yavana Kasaraya, Yenye Chapapa, Yadapashrayashraya. Shudyanti Tasmai Pavavishnave Namaha. Even these categories, who are beneath Varnashram, they're not considered really part of human society, even strictly speaking. But even them, if they take shelter of Krishna, they can also reach the supreme destination. So, what to speak of the Vaishyas, what to speak of the Sudras, what to speak of women who are properly situated in Varnashram, they can certainly achieve the supreme destination. Even the dog-eaters, yavanas, malechas. And in 33, Krishna makes the point that so obviously the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, they can easily achieve perfection. It's no problem for them. They have great opportunity. And then in 34, he briefly describes the process that we should follow, that these people, these different classes of people should follow in order to achieve this goal of perfection of life. Manmana, we should always think of Krishna, Maya Sakta Mana, as Krishna said at the beginning of the 7th chapter. Mind should be fixed on Krishna. Mad bhaktam. Everything you do should be done as a service to Krishna. We should offer respect to Krishna. We should worship him. And if we're really absorbed and attached, absorbed in Krishna, attached to Krishna in these ways, then surely we'll come to him. Any of you not signed yourselves present? Just keep passing it around. So now we'll go on to the 10th chapter. The first section is verses 1 to 7. Now, it's interesting to note, in verse 1, Krishna says that I'm going to give you knowledge which is even better than what I've already explained. Now, we might think that how could Krishna give better knowledge? What we've heard is really quite extraordinary. But as we'll see, particularly in the Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita, verses 8, 9, 10, and 11, Krishna gives some knowledge which is even better than what we've heard so far. Quite extraordinary. So in verse 2, Krishna makes the point that even the greatest people in the material world can't understand him. The demigods and the great sages. There's no one greater than them in this material world. But even they can't understand him. Why? It's a very interesting reason he gives. Because he is their source. Now you might think, well, you know, why would that affect their understanding him? But if you think about it, you'll realize that if something comes from something else, like we have come from our parents, so actually it's very difficult for us to really understand our parents clearly. It's very difficult. And we can get some idea. But to really understand them very, very clearly is difficult. So this is the principle Krishna is referring to here. That if something is the source of something, then that thing which has come from that source finds it very difficult to really understand the source very clearly. So then Krishna goes on to elaborate on this. That if you know me as three things, Aja, unborn, Anadi, beginningless, and Lokamaheshwaram, if you can understand me in these three ways, then you'll be liberated. And in fact, only this sort of person can really, truly be liberated. So, our acharyas give a very interesting analysis of these three terms. Unborn, or these three concepts of being unborn, being beginningless, and being Lokamaheshwaram, or the controller of the universe. So, and this is in reference to the last verse, in which Krishna is saying that the demigods and great sages can't understand him. So they point out that Lord Brahma is known also as Aja. That is one name of Lord Brahma. So Krishna is saying that I'm Aja. But Lord Brahma is also Aja. So what is the difference between Krishna and Lord Brahma then? They're both Aja. But Lord Brahma is not Anadi. He's not beginningless. And similarly, the great sages, the Maharishis, they're also known as being Aja, but they're not Anadi. But then, has anyone still not marked themselves present? So just keep on, as long as we get it back by the end of the program. So now there's a certain class of great sages who are called the Nityamukta Maharishis. They're Aja, unborn, and they're also known to be Anadi, beginningless. So how is Krishna different from them? Because he's Lokamaheshwaram. He's the controller of all the worlds, of the whole universe, and they're not. Then the demigods in general, they're Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. They're controlling the whole universe. But they're not Aja. They're not unborn. and they're not beginning this. So the point is that Krishna is being distinguished very clearly from these other groups of people. And then even our acharyas say that some people say, as we heard in chapter 7, that Krishna is Brahman, and that Brahman has taken birth. If you remember, I think it's verse 24 of chapter 7. But Krishna says that he's Aja, he's unborn. So this concept of Krishna, if we're to say that Krishna and Brahman are the same, because Krishna is Aja, then this idea is shown to be invalid, that Krishna is Brahman, but the Brahman has taken birth, because Krishna is Aja, he doesn't take birth. And then they go on to say that Krishna is distinguished from the Supersoul. The Supersoul is Aja, Anadi, and Loka Maheshwara. But now there's a difference, and this is a little more, it's not really mentioned here specifically. But in one sense, Krishna is not Aja. He's not unborn. Because he takes birth as the son of Devaki or the son of Mother Yasoda. So in this way, Krishna is distinguished from the demigods, the Maharishis, Brahman, and even Paramatma. So if we understand Krishna, Bhagavan, Krishna says, Ma, Yo Ma, Ajam Anadincha. If you understand me, this means Krishna is Bhagavan. In my unique position, then you can be liberated. And our acharyas say that this verse fulfills the statement made in chapter 4, verse 9. Who can remember what is chapter 4, verse 9? Any of the Matajis? Mataji? Right. Janma karma chame divya. That Krishna's appearance and activities are transcendental. And if you understand that, then you won't take birth again, but you'll go to Krishna. So this verse fulfills that particular verse. In verses 4 and 5, a number of important qualities are mentioned. We won't go through them all. Our acharyas explain that Krishna is mentioning all these very, well, most of them are good qualities, but anyway, all these different qualities and things. For the same reason, that just as the demigods and sages can't understand me, so also you cannot understand me simply through having these qualities. Because these qualities are coming from me also. So they won't really help you to understand me. So we might ask, how are we going to understand Krishna? Which is a very good question. And the answer, it's not actually stated here, it's stated a little later on. Only by Krishna's mercy, or the mercy of his devotees, which in a sense is the same thing. But not independently. Not because you're a big, powerful demigod. Not because you're a big, liberated sage. Not because you're Brahman realized. Not because you're Paramatma realized. But only by Krishna's mercy or the mercy of those who already have Krishna's mercy. And then again, verse 6 mentions some more important people. The seven great sages. Then the four other great sages, that's the four Kumaras. Even the Manus. They're also coming from Krishna. So why mention them? Because they also can't understand Krishna. Unless Krishna reveals himself or he is revealed to them by the mercy of Krishna's devotees. But then in verse 7, Krishna makes the point that if you do understand me, if you get at least a reasonable understanding of me, of course we can't understand Krishna totally, it's not possible. But at least if we get some reasonable understanding of Krishna, then we become convinced that yes, Krishna is so great, we have some faith in Krishna, and then as Krishna says here, then you'll engage in devotional service. Prabhupada said that religion without philosophy is just a sentiment. So you may think, oh, I love Krishna. Krishna's so great. But if you don't understand Krishna and how Krishna's working, how his energies are working, then you may think, oh, Krishna's very nice. But when Maya attacks you, your faith in Krishna will be very easily shaken. So to have this understanding of Krishna is very, very important. So now we go on to the second section, which is verses 8 to 11. This is called the Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita, or the entire message of Bhagavad Gita in four verses. Bhagavad Gita in a nutshell. So our acharyas give some very nice explanations about these verses. First of all, verse 8. Krishna is saying, Aham Sarvasya Prabhava. I'm the source of everything. The spiritual worlds and material worlds, Prabhupada mentions in the verse, in the translation. But it's not only that. Our acharyas explain that this includes Brahma, Paramatma, the whole Vaikuntha realm, all the avatars, everything, whatever exists, Krishna is including here. That every single thing in existence comes from me. And if you understand this nicely, Buddha, then you'll engage in unalloyed devotional service, bhava samanvita. This term bhava is used because bhava is the stage just next to love of God, just before love of God. So you can achieve that level. Then in verse 9, Krishna explains the activities of those devotees who have understood him and who have engaged in devotional service, or who are engaging in devotional service on the basis of that understanding. They're always thinking of him. They're always dedicated to serving him. And they're very happy to discuss about him, to hear and chant about him together. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives a nice commentary. He says, their minds become, he's speaking as Krishna, their minds become completely eager to hear my names and pastimes. Their life ears have come to me. Without me, they cannot maintain their lives. This is their food. And Baladev Vijayabhushan says, they cannot live without Krishna. Just like fish out of water, they feel desperate to be in Krishna consciousness. He says, it's as if they become lusty to hear about Krishna. So, you can just get some idea of how intense their attachment to Krishna is. That they must hear about Krishna. They just cannot do without it. So as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Kabe habe bolo se dinama. When, oh, when will that day be mine? When will that day be ours? That we'll have this fierce desire that we must be Krishna conscious. And if there's something which is trying to interfere, then we feel terribly disturbed. So it's like that. He says that tusyanti cha ramanti cha. They experience, they derive great satisfaction and bliss. Tusyanti means satisfaction, ramanti means bliss. So Baladev Vijayabhushan says that tusyanti, satisfaction, is the result which the devotee who is practicing vaidhi sadhana bhakti experiences. If you're practicing Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, everything is going very nicely, your mind is relatively under control, circumstances are favorable, you're getting absorbed in Krishna consciousness somewhat, then you experience satisfaction. Whereas Ramante, bliss, ecstasy, refers to those who are practicing Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti, spontaneous practicing spontaneous devotional service, following in the footsteps of the inhabitants of Vrindavan, they become ecstatic, blissful, overwhelmed with bliss. So verse 10, to those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada is mainly explaining this verse in terms of a person who is either illiterate or perhaps physically removed from the association of devotees, so therefore doesn't really have access to so much information about Krishna. That at least if that person is sincere, then Krishna will reveal everything. Prabhupada says in the third paragraph, a person may have a bona fide spiritual master and may be attached to a spiritual organization, but still, if he's not intelligent enough to make progress, then Krishna from within gives him instructions so that he may ultimately come to him without difficulty. And the same idea is there, Prabhupada explains the next verse, verse 11, basically in the same way, mainly, although in the last paragraph of the purport to verse 11, Prabhupada also introduces a somewhat higher concept, that is of Krishna revealing himself to the devotee and bringing the devotee to the level of perfection, entering into their eternal relationship with Krishna. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes some very interesting comments on these two verses. This is really like this most confidential knowledge which Krishna is referring to. He says that in verse 10, the devotee is described as being bhajatam priti purvakam, engaging in devotional service with love. Priti means love. In other words, prema. This devotee is on the level of prema. Now, if the devotee is on the level of prema, then what is the question of buddhi yoga? Generally, the term buddhi yoga refers to karma yoga. You're using your intelligence. So now, why, he raises the question, why does Krishna use this term buddhi yoga? What is this buddhi? Because the devotee is already so advanced, extremely perfect, actually, basically perfect. So what is the question of some buddhi yoga, which is more or less like a lower concept? So, he says that Arjuna asks, in between 9 and 10, so the devotees are practicing like this, but how do they enter into their personal relationship with you? And then Krishna speaks, verse 10. He says, I give them the inspiration within their hearts. It doesn't come from within themselves. In other words, it's not coming from them. It doesn't come from within themselves. It doesn't come from any other source. It only comes from me. And it can only be accepted by them. Then they come into my direct association. So this buddhi yoga is this inspiration. It is me. It is my personal association. So he's explaining that what Krishna is saying is that this buddhi yoga which Krishna gives the devotee who's on the level of prema is that he reveals himself. He reveals their eternal relationship with them. And then he allows them to enter into their eternal relationship with him. So this is like the most confidential knowledge. How one ultimately enters into one's eternal relationship with Krishna. And then Krishna speaks verse 11. So Vishnu, or both of our acharyas, I took bits and pieces from both of their purports. They say that Krishna says, for these devotees I give by my mercy a special type of knowledge. course, that knowledge is mainly knowledge of their eternal relationship with Him. Due to anadi karma, the beginningless ocean of karmic reactions which we have managed to develop in so many lifetimes in this material world, whatever traces of ignorance there may still be there, there may still be, due to their anadi karma, I personally remove. And then I manifest my transcendental qualities and my transcendental form for them. So, it's not a subject we can really go into right now, but Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in one other book, Madhurya Kadambini, he explains that a devotee, on the level of bhava, may still be affected by, not so much their sinful reactions, but the after effects of their offenses. In fact, this is the main reason why a devotee who's on the level of bhava is not on the level of prema. You know, why should that devotee not be on the level of prema? There's no question of any sinful activity or anything that's been left behind long ago. So why are they not on the level of prema if they're on the level of bhava? Because there's still some traces, particularly of reactions to offenses. And he says, even when the devotee comes to the level of prema, there may still be some faint traces. But when Krishna reveals himself personally, then those last faint traces are completely removed when the devotee enters into their eternal relationship with Krishna. So that is what Krishna is explaining here. And that is like this, what we would say is this most confidential knowledge. And you can see that all this most confidential knowledge has been revealed by Krishna right in the middle of the middle section of Bhagavad Gita. In the later half of the ninth chapter and the first part of the tenth chapter. It's the very heart of Bhagavad Gita that this most confidential knowledge of the intimate relationship between Krishna and his devotees has been explained. So now Arjuna, having heard this, we're going on to the next section, 12 to 18. Arjuna is pretty astonished by all this, pretty overwhelmed. So he expresses himself that I accept you completely. Now I'm completely convinced. Not only am I convinced that all the great sages, Asita, Narada, Devala, Vyas, so many great authorities, they're convinced. You are the Supreme Lord. I accept you, and I accept everything that you're saying. Arjuna expressed that type of sentiment, or the beginnings of it, in chapter 2, verse 7. But now, Arjuna has reached that point that he's really convinced, fully convinced. Uh, 14 and 15, Arjuna's making the point that only you know yourself. The demigods, demons, and others, they can't understand. They can't understand you. And then in verse 16, 17, and 18, he asks Krishna, "Will you please tell me about your opulences? I want to think of you. You told me, Maya Saktamana Parata. You told me that my mind, I should get my mind attached to you. So now I want to do that. So you please reveal things to me about yourself which my mind will become attached to, and then I'll be very absorbed in thinking of you." In his commentary, in verse 18, Krishna, Arjuna is saying that I'm never satiated in hearing about you. The more I hear, the more I want to taste the nectar of your words. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur makes the point that Arjuna's ears are becoming like tongues. We all know what the tongue is like. When the tongue decides, it really wants to taste something very nice. That's a very strong impulse. So Arjuna's two ears are becoming like tongues. They're becoming overwhelmed with a blazing desire to hear about Krishna. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says that Arjuna, or the pure devotee, experiences these subject matters about Krishna to be like a very special type of nectar drink. We all know what nectar drinks are like. They're very nectarian. But he says this is a very special nectar drink. Then he describes some of the qualities of it. He says it's like honey. It's a nectar drink, not like water. You just pour it and it just sort of splashes out. It's like honey. You turn it up and it oozes out. It's very thick and very luscious and very rich and very sweet and delectable. I don't know if you know what I mean. But it's a very special nectar drink that even when you're completely full, you just can't stop yourself taking some more of it. Like that. Just the most luscious experience for the tongue. So the pure devotee's ears are like that. They're tasting these glories of Krishna to be just like this rich nectar. So then from verse 19 to the end of the chapter, we're actually not going to go through all these statements, but Krishna is basically explaining about his manifestations mainly within the material world. He says, I am this, I am that. Of the Adityas, I am Vishnu. Of lights, I am the sun. Among stars, I am the moon. And so on and so forth. Now, I don't think there's really a need to go through all of these in detail. Maybe a couple we could refer to. But the basic principle is that it's not exactly that all of these things are Krishna in person. Like Krishna says in verse 22, among the senses, I am the mind. Now, in the beginning of chapter 6, we read a bit about the mind. The mind can be your friend, but your mind can be your enemy. I'm sure we've all had experience of our mind being our enemy. But Krishna is saying that I am your mind. So does that mean that whatever comes into your mind, that is worshipable? No. Our minds sometimes are like, sort of like rubbish bins. You know, at least that problem is there for the aspiring devotees. How to deal with the mind. But if you think, oh, my mind is Krishna in person, so my mind is completely transcendental and worshipable. That's not actually the case. But what is the case is that the mind is such an extraordinary thing. Where could such a thing as the mind have come from? Only from a very extraordinary person, and that is Krishna. So all of these things. Krishna is pointing out so many things within this material world which are very extraordinary. And they're so extraordinary that when you see them, then you can think that this is so extraordinary. It couldn't have come out of nowhere. It could only have come from some very extraordinary person, God, Krishna. So it's in this sense that Krishna is speaking. He says, amongst fishes, I'm the shark. Don't know if any of you have ever bumped into a shark while you've been swimming. I won't go into my past history, but I used to surf a lot, too much. And I almost bumped into two sharks on two occasions. I came within about 10 yards of them. Fortunately, they were just cruising along. They weren't hungry. Otherwise, I might not be here today. But if I had thought, a shark, there's Krishna. Krishna says amongst fishes, I'm the shark. Then thought, I must go and embrace him. Well, anyway. But still, the shark is interesting. The shark, there are two living beings who have no enemies. No natural enemies. One is the human being. Human beings have no real natural enemies. They're capable basically of defending themselves against anything. And the other is the shark. The shark has no predators. So, very extraordinary. Where could such an extraordinary thing have come from? Only Krishna. Or Krishna says, I'm the gambling of cheats. So that doesn't mean that we should become expert cheaters and rascals and think that, oh, this is very good, I'm becoming just like Krishna. No, but the idea is these are all very extraordinary things. They could only come from an extraordinary source, and that is Krishna. So actually the whole of the rest of the chapter is taken up with this discussion. Krishna explaining that he's explaining in terms of groups, generally. Of hymns, I'm the Brihatsama. Of all poetry, I'm the Gayatri. Of fishes, I'm the shark. And of wielders of weapons, I'm Ram. So in terms of groups, one interesting thing, it's an interesting thing which is, I think, often misunderstood. In verse 34, Krishna says, among women, I'm fame, fortune, fine speech, memory, intelligence, steadfastness, and patience. So, of course, these are very good qualities for women. They're also very good qualities for men. If you have them, and we're hearing here that they are qualities of women, if you're a man and you have them, doesn't mean that you're somehow endowed with an effeminate nature or something like that. But actually what it is, there are two ways of understanding the statement. Subtle ways. Is that these words, in Sanskrit you have genders, three genders, masculine, feminine, and neuter. So these words are in the feminine gender. That's one thing. They're in the feminine gender, just like in French you have masculine and feminine, at least. Latin. So these words are in feminine gender. Another thing is that these are the names of some very famous women. Shri, goddess of fortune, Vak, the daughter of Lord Brahma. These are the names of some very famous women. So anyway, then Krishna concludes the chapter by saying that, this is now verses 39, 40, 41, and 42. He says that these things may be very impressive to you, but actually they're nothing. As manifestations of my potency, they are really very insignificant. In fact, whatever you find in the entire material creation is very insignificant. It's just springing from a spark of my splendor. So don't take it too seriously. So why? Why do you need to bother? You don't need to bother too much with all this. Who? Well, one. Try one.
Please repeat with reference to verse 3 of chapter 10. How this differentiates Krishna from the impersonal Brahma?
Because some people say that Krishna is the Brahman, but that Brahman has taken birth in the form of Krishna. But here Krishna says that he is Aja, he's unborn. So therefore this idea that Krishna is Brahman, but that Brahman has somehow taken birth as Krishna, that is not a correct idea. Because Krishna is Aja. Just a...
You explained that this verse 34, and chapter, is which describes these feminine qualities, these names, this word also refers to different famous women.
Yeah.
Say something more, because I never heard about...
Well, you heard of Sri...
Yeah, I heard, but about...
Vak.
No.
Vak is the daughter of Brahma. Actually, anyway, it's also Saraswati. Well, yeah, Brahma's got an unusual situation. His daughter is his wife. Anyway, he's very transcendental. But we know that there was a very extraordinary incident early on in the creation where Brahma chased after Vak. Anyway, I mean, I won't go into the intricacies of it, but Vak...
Is also name of Saraswati.
Yeah. Vak means words. And Saraswati also means words. She's the presiding deity of words or knowledge. Then the others made her... I don't really know so much about them, but they're famous ladies. Kirti, Sri Vak, Narinan, Swati. Made her. They're famous ladies from the Puranas. Sorry, I can't be more specific. Can you? Well, I don't think we have time.
Did you say in regards to chapter 9, verse 32, that there are four categories to refer to?
Well, it can be taken as four categories. It can also be taken as three. Yeah. Prabhupada generally takes it as three. That this Papa Yoni refers to Stri, Sudra, and Vaishya. But the Acharyas also take the Papa Yoni to refer to those who are lower than Stri, Vaishya, and Sudra. The Chandalas, Lamechas, and Yamanas, and others, Karatas, who knows.
What is the significance
of Well, that's a good question. I don't know, actually. The holy fig. I don't know if any of you know, I couldn't venture a good answer to that. The banyan tree. Why is it so sacred, the holy fig? Well, it's one particular... There are different species of banyan. It's, as I understand, it's one particular species of banyan. Like the peepal tree, it's also related. That's also regarded as being very auspicious. But quite frankly, I don't know exactly why. Yeah, that's true. Just before Krishna left, he was sitting under a young banyan tree, leaning up against it, with one foot over his one other knee. Anyway, I don't know about that. Anyone else? Any other question?
In 8th chapter, I ask about that because I don't have previous good in verse 22nd, Krishna explained the position of Supreme Lord, and he referred that he said that he... Krishna speak about Supreme
Me
Lord,
and
that
he,
and sometimes he...
Yeah, right. Now that's a good point. That's a very good point.
Why Krishna in this...
Me and he.
He said that he are Supreme Lord, he is resigned.
Yeah. Okay. Well, see, Krishna and Vishnu and Krishna and all his expansions are not different. Like Lord Nrisimhadev is Krishna. But he's not manifesting fully. It's Krishna manifesting a certain feature of his nature, particularly his anger. But still it's Krishna. It's not like someone else, like you and me. I'm one person, you're another. Nrisimhadev is Krishna, but just manifesting in a special way. But at the same time, Nrisimhadeva is Nrisimhadeva. And you can't exactly say that he is Krishna, you know, Shamsunda playing the flute in Vrindavan. He's not. So therefore sometimes Krishna, when Krishna is referring more to the supersoul or other expansions, particularly the supersoul, then he sometimes, not always, but sometimes in Bhagavad Gita, he refers to the supersoul as he and not me. Like chapter 18, verse, I think, 61. What is that verse? Ishvara Sarabhutana, Rideshya Junatishti, Brahmayan Sarabhutani, Yachu Rujanimaya. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart. And then, just after that, he says, you should surrender to him, absolutely, or something like that, completely. You should surrender to him. But now that's the supersoul, Vishnu. Also he says, Sabhasyacham Riddhi Sanavishto Mata Smriti Gyanam Aponam Cha, that I'm seated in everyone's heart. So it's a fact that the supersoul is Krishna, but then again it's not exactly Krishna in person. So in order to distinguish himself, Krishna, the original form, from his expanded forms, sometimes Krishna refers to the expanded forms in the third person, as he, as he. So here he's basically in chapter 8, he's referring to Vishnu. He's all-pervading, everything situated within them. That is basically Vishnu, the Lord within this material realm. Dr. James?
With regards to verse 9-11,
yeah, 9-11.
The form of Krishna is the absolute truth, and he used the picture of Krishna there on the wall as an example.
Yeah, right.
So, and he said that any bona fide picture of Krishna is the absolute truth. So I was wondering how we could understand that, first of all, what is bona fide, and that within any picture of Krishna is the complete absolute truth, including us.
Yeah. If that picture is done according to the instructions of scripture, basically, and it's faithfully, sort of externally at least, it faithfully represents what Krishna essentially looks like, then that's accepted as bona fide. One way in which it's expressed, which is rather nice, particularly in regard to pure devotees who are artists. The pure devotee, who's an artist, is meditating on Krishna. And within his or her mind, the devotee is seeing Krishna very clearly. So now, because that's such an elevated devotee, then there's no doubt that that form within their mind is definitely Krishna. Krishna is present within their minds, within their hearts. So now, when they paint the picture, or carve the sculpture, or whatever it may be, then what do? They just take that form which is in their mind and just place it outside. So it's just that form which is Krishna within their minds, within their hearts, manifesting externally. So in this way it's definitely bona fide and can be accepted as being Krishna in person. Okay, so tomorrow we're going to read chapter 11. We may go on to chapter 12. So please do read chapters 11 and 12. Srila Prabhupada ki.